Today we are going to finish Psalm 2. We started it last week, and then we're going to go back into David a little bit. Possibility we could get to Psalm 3 today. Your notes that I sent out have Psalm 3 in it, but we might be next week before we get to Psalm 3. But if we go back to Psalm 2, just a quick review of what we did last week. Psalm 2 has four parts, four sections, verse 1 through 3, 4 to 6, 7 to 9, and 10 to 12. In each of those sections, there's a different speaker. And the first section, the speaker is the narrator, and then the rebellious rulers speak. And in this section, as we reviewed last week, the nations are raging against God and against His anointed. And we talked about how that really happens. And the nations, the unbelieving nations, hate God. And they're going to do everything they can to not have to abide by what God says. And then, well, let's read that real quickly. It says, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us." They are in a rage against God and against His anointed. And as we are going to find out, the anointed is the Messiah, who is Jesus Christ. So they're against God and against His anointed. And then we talked a little bit about God's response to that. And that is in the second section, which is in verses 4 through 6. "He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then He will speak to them in His wrath and terrify them in His fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill." So even though the nations rage against God, God scoffs. God scoffs at them, says, "You guys don't have a clue." And they don't. Then the next section, which is where we ended last week, is in verse 7 through 9. Now, the person speaking here is God's anointed, or the Messiah, that who is speaking in verse 7 to 9. So it contains the words of God's anointed, the Messiah, or as we find out later in the Bible, Jesus Christ. And he says this, "I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me." Now he is quoting, the anointed is quoting the Father, but the anointed is the one speaking. "The Lord said to me," and this is the king that is speaking that was referred to in verse 6. "The Lord said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. And you shall break them with the rod of iron and dice them to pieces like the potter's vessel." Now, if you want to turn to Acts 13:33, we can show why we know that this is speaking about Jesus Christ. Turn to Acts 13. We'll go back to verse 32. And it says, "And we preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers, that God fulfilled His promise to our children, that He raised up Jesus, as it is written in the second psalm." I mean, it's pretty black and white, right? "Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee." So, it's clear from Acts that the person there's talking about in Psalm 2 is Jesus Christ. Turn to Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 5. Talking about Jesus Christ. In verse 2 of Hebrews 1, it says, "In these last days he has spoken to us in his Son, who he appointed heir of all things." Then you go down to verse 4. "For to which of the angels did he ever say, 'Thou art my Son, today I have begotten thee?'" Again, referring to Christ. And then go to Hebrews chapter 5, verse 5. "So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, 'Thou art my Son, today I have begotten thee.'" So it's about as clear as you can be. This is talking about Jesus Christ. The passage in Acts tells of God fulfilling this promise of Psalm 2, which also shows that Psalm 2 is a psalm of prophecy. And the passage in Hebrews quotes from this, speaking to the divine nature of Jesus Christ and the priesthood of Jesus. Now, another point to bring out here, it says, "You are my Son, today I have begotten you." It does not mean that before today, the appointed one did not exist, because we know from John 1:2 that Jesus was in the beginning with God. There wasn't a time he was not begotten. And as we just read in Acts 13, this is in reference to God raising Jesus after his death. In Colossians 1:18, it says that Jesus is the firstborn from the dead. So, it's not talking about a non-existence and then an existence. Now, even through this event, the raising of Jesus will occur in the future. It's spoken of like it already took place. It already happened, because it's for sure. And the Bible does that a lot. Then in verse 8, God the Father states that his anointed, who is Jesus, needs only to ask, and the nations of the earth are his, to the very ends of the earth. We also see in this section the power of God, that there is nothing that has any strength when compared against the strength of God. Of course, in the first part of this psalm, the kings and the rulers of the earth thought they had all this strength, and God's saying, yeah, you don't have any strength. Because it says here in verse 8, "Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and the ends of earth your possession." And then it says, "You shall break them with a rod of iron, and dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel." Now, rod has a few different meanings, or a few different applications in Scripture. A wooden rod became to be known as the insignia for royalty. You would have a wooden rod or a scepter. And it shows authority and it shows reign. And there's also a shepherd's rod. Now, a shepherd's rod was used in keeping the sheep. It had multiple functions. It was a weapon for defense. It was an extension of the shepherd's arm. And so it was a symbol of power and strength, because the rod was an extension of his arm. It was used for defense. It was used for discipline for the sheep, for their well-being. Smack the sheep somewhere so he wouldn't go over the cliff and that type of thing to get him back. It was a loving discipline so the sheep wouldn't do something hurtful to himself. And then it was also used for protection. You would ward away other creatures that would come in and try to smack the sheep. So in verse 9, we have this rod of iron that will accomplish a complete destruction of the unbelieving nations of the world. And of course, when this is accomplished, the anointed one, or the Messiah, or Jesus Christ, will have the nations as his heritage and the ends of earth as his possession when that is totally accomplished. So then we have, concluding the messianic references to this psalm, go to Revelation chapter 1. Revelation 1:5, it says, "And from Christ, Jesus Christ, the faithful witness, the firstborn of the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth." He's the ruler of the kings of the earth. "To him who loves us and released us from our sins by his blood." And then you go to Revelation 2:27. This is one of the messages to one of the churches in Asia. Verse 26, "He who overcomes and he who keeps my deeds until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations, and he shall rule them with the rod of iron. The vessels of the potter are broken to pieces." So Jesus is the ruler of the kings of the earth. And go to Revelation 12:5. "And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and on his throne." So we see kind of that tie-in. And then in the fourth section of this psalm, the narrator concludes. And this section is addressed back to the kings and the leaders who started out this psalm. They are admonished to do a few things that they weren't doing in the front at the first. Verse 10, "Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all those who take refuge in him." So they are admonished to the first thing, show discernment, to be wise. That's not a bad thing for any king to do. But clearly they were not doing it in verse 1. Proverbs is right on when it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." So how are these nations' leaders to be wise, to show discernment? Well, they have to fear the Lord. If they don't fear the Lord, that wisdom and that discernment is not going to be there. If you reject the commands of God, you will only be a fool. And then, after it says be wise, it says be warned. Take warning. What God says is going to happen is going to happen. It's going to come to pass. We need to act in the knowledge of God's truth and his coming kingdom. Then after that, it says serve the Lord with fear. A guy named William Bates has this quote based on this section. This fear of God qualifies our joy. If you abstract fear from joy, joy will become light and wanton. If you abstract joy from fear, fear will then become slavish. And that's what the kingdom, the rulers are told to serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Rejoice with trembling. God alone is worthy of our worship. Sadly, and we all know this, our culture spends its time worshiping the self. It is everywhere and it's going exactly 180 degrees the opposite direction. And we need to make sure we do not buy into that cultural climate of self. And it's easy to say that, but as I look around, many Christian churches today, their worship service is focused on self and not on God. I see it all the time. It's focused on self. I hardly ever do this. Is I read a few Facebook things, but you'll very seldom see a post from me. Every once in a while, I'll get, I'll do it. Well, there was a person in this one thing. It says, does anybody know of a good church in Scottsdale, Arizona area where we can go and wear casual cold clothes like shorts and flip-flops? And I had to say something. So I wrote back and I said, the first thing you need to do is focus on where you need to go to get teaching. And then wear whatever's appropriate for that place. If it's flip-flops and shorts, I don't care. But if it's suits and tie, go get a suit and tie. You know, don't go somewhere where it meets your need. That's turning everything around to self. And actually, they responded back to me in a kind of a nice way. I wasn't real snotty or nothing, you know. But the point is, we need to worship God based on our worship to Him, not on what's convenient for us, not on what helps us. And a lot of the worship portions of the services today are focused on self. And you can go out and look on YouTube and find millions of them. But what we need to do is worship God. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling to put God first place. And whatever we have to do, then we do. And then it says, kiss the anointed one. Kiss the Son. That means to homage to it. The English Standard and the King James say kiss. The New American Standard says do homage to the Son. But the word comes from the word for worship. And the Greek word for worship means to turn toward and kiss, to express appreciation and devotion to, like you would kiss the hand of a sovereign. That's what that's for. So it's to express this devotion and this appreciation for. So kiss the Son, lest he be, this is interesting, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Verse 12 says that those who do not worship the Son will experience the wrath of God. And this is a hard line. The Bible is constant, or can, you know, always like this. If you do reject God, you will experience His wrath. And it's not open to negotiation. I can't say, well, you know, that's okay. No, God is very clear and unmovable in this. Worship the God in His way. But sadly, most will follow the ways of the kings and the leaders who plot in vain, who set themselves and take counsel against the Lord and against His anointed. And then it goes back, this psalm ends with something that reminds us back to Psalm 1. Blessed are all who take refuge in Him. Remember Psalm 1, who is blessed? Right? Blessed are all those who take refuge in Him. It seems like a clear choice. You want to be blessed? Take refuge in God. You don't? Guess what? The wrath of the Son will come and you will perish in the way. That is Psalm 2. Pretty good psalm. Wait till you get to Psalm 3. I don't know if we'll make that today. But let's jump back into the life of David. The life of David. Now we ended up last week in the life of David with David marrying Michal, Saul's daughter, which is not going to be a good choice. He shouldn't have done that. We'll find out a lot of reasons, not all this week. But now we're in 1 Samuel 19.
First or second?
first. Oops. It says first up on top. It says second over here. You know, the problem with that is I'm trying to study ahead, and I am in the middle of 2 Samuel now. And so that was just a slip. 1 Samuel chapter 19. And I just turned to 2 Samuel. No, my bad. I'll try to fix that. And what we have in 1 Samuel 19 is kind of the beginning of David's fleeing from Saul. Verse 19, verse 1. Now, Saul was not to be deterred from his obsession to kill David. He gave David his daughter to marry and said, "You got to go kill 100 Philistines," thinking that's going to kill David. David goes out and kills 200 Philistines. He goes out and makes him a captain of 1,000 so he might get killed in battle, and none of that's working. And Saul was not going to be deterred. He told Jonathan in verse 1, his son and all his servants to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So Saul was growing more desperate, and he basically ceased trying to hide his goal of killing David. It's now public. Of course, I don't think Saul understood the fierce loyalty between Jonathan and David, or he wouldn't have said, "Hey, go kill David," and he goes, "Hey, he's my buddy." So Jonathan went to David and told him, "Hey, guess what my dad's trying to do?" He told David to go and hide. And Jonathan then would be a spy for David as to Saul's dealings. And we see this in verse 2 and 3. So Jonathan told David, saying, "Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now, therefore," and I don't think that was news to David, but maybe the intensity of it might have been, "Oh, this is worse than I thought." Now, David just married, you know, Saul was his father-in-law, right? He says, "Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. And if I find out anything, I will tell you." So David knew that Jonathan was sincere. There wasn't this covert thing that Jonathan was saying, "Hey, I'll go trick Saul." No, Jonathan meant it. There was a real friendship there. Now, remember, too, Jonathan was the heir to the throne. But Jonathan was not striving for that title or that position. He didn't see David as a competitor for that throne. I don't think Jonathan cared if he was king or not. He knew that David was anointed by God, and he said, "That's good. I'm not going to fight that." But not only was he going to warn David of his father's intentions, he also went to his father on behalf of David and said, "Why are you trying to do this?" Verse 4. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said to him, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine," talking about Goliath, "and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel, and you saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause?" So he's kind of appealing to Saul's intellect here, and he brings up some good points. And at least at the service, on the surface, Saul listened. Now, he didn't listen for long. And said, "And Saul listened," verse 6, "And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, 'As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death.'" That's one thing to vow, but then he's "As God lives, you know, God is my witness, I'm not going to do this." Well, clearly we're going to find out he didn't mean that, or he meant it but didn't maintain that but at all. And then we have in verse 8, right after that, war broke out between the Philistines, and David went out to resume his military activities and was very successful in verse 8. There was a great slaughter, and the Philistines fled before David. You think Saul was up, boy, Jonathan, thank you, you did good. If we wouldn't have had David, we might have had much more trouble with the Philistines. Well, no, in verse 9, comes right back. Now there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul, and he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. He liked to sit with his spear in his hand a lot. And David was playing the harp with his hand. So David was back in the court of the king helping to soothe Saul. He had done this before, and Saul tried to take the spear and pin him against the wall. Well, Saul didn't have a whole lot of new tricks up his sleeve. And Saul tried, and again in verse 10, and Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped out of Saul's presence. So he struck the spear into the wall. So he missed. Now, how long there was between verses 8 and 9, we don't know. Was it a day? Was it a week? Was it a month? I don't think it was very long. But David had gone back trying to soothe the king with his music, but it didn't last. Saul tried to kill him again. Yes?
It says an evil spirit from the Lord.
Yeah, an evil spirit from the Lord.
I mean, that's kind of confusing.
Yeah, I think we had that question. Somebody else asked that. The evil spirit from Saul opened himself up to the evil. The Lord allowed that to come into him. You know, it's kind of like when Pharaoh hardened his heart against God, and God said, okay. Saul opened himself up to this spirit. God said to this demon, go get into Saul. Saul opened himself up to that. And so it wasn't that God sent it, God allowed it because Saul wanted it. That makes sense, kind of?
Kind of. Maybe it's the translation saying from the Lord.
Yeah. I'll try to look in that, maybe have a little clearer, concise answer that talks about the words there. Yes?
Yeah, and when Jesus was talking to Peter and said, Satan has asked that he might sift you as wheat. In that way, of course, the enemy wanted to sift Saul as wheat, and the Lord allowed a distressing spirit to have his way with Saul in some ways.
And Saul was not fighting.
Right.
Saul wanted that.
Right.
And we're going to see a little later that Saul, that Saul prophesied because the Spirit of God was on him too. But that doesn't. See, we didn't have the indwelling Spirit like we have today. It's a totally different animal. Yes?
I believe in Psalm 104, when you're craving something more than the manna, it says that God sent quail. It said he gave them what they desired, but he sent leanness to their soul. It made them kind of wither up and miserable in their spirit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he answers our prayer, but it teaches a lesson.
Saul didn't seem to get the lesson.
No,
I have to wonder, well, A.W. Pink says this about Saul's prior resolve vowed to not kill David. He said this, where the fear of God does not process the heart, in other words, doesn't get into your heart, fresh temptations soon arouse the dormant corruptions. And this gives Satan good opportunity to regain complete mastery over his victim. And I think that pretty well states what happened to Saul.
Meant his vow.
No, it was just
words.
Yeah. Well, he might have meant it just like, I'm going to quit smoking someday. I mean it, but I'll never do it. I mean, I've known a lot of people because you're addicted to it. You might want to, but you can't on your own power. And that's kind of what Saul was like. Yeah.
Where did you get that quote?
Arthur W. Pink, A.W. Pink. That's a lot of the source document I'm using.
Would you repeat it for me, please?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm slow.
You going to write all these words down?
No.
Oh. Where the fear of the God does not possess the heart, fresh temptations soon arouse the dormant corruptions. And this gives Satan good opportunity to regain complete mastery over his victim.
I'm pretty sure that most of us, if not all of us, have experienced that in our own lives.
Sure.
I have.
Yeah, we're not perfect. But as we're going to find out from David, the big difference between David and Saul never repented for what he did. David did some pretty bad stuff, but he repented. He was a man after God's own heart. He was far from perfect. Marrying Michal was one of those things. And we're going to find out more. But he went back and repented. I wonder really again how David got out of there. But he got out of there because he was protected by God. And he understood this. Later he would write in Psalm 34 after another rescue from God. Psalm 34:7, David wrote, "The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them." David experienced that firsthand. And then the next several verses 11 to 17, tell about Saul's pursuit of David and going to Michal, how Michal protected David. It says, Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him. This is after he avoided the spear, in order to put him to death in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you're going to be put to death." So Michal knew what was going on. So Michal let David down through a window. He went out and fled and escaped. And Michal took the household idol and laid it on the bed and put a quilt of goat's hair on its head and covered it with clothes, a dummy. Saul sent messengers to take David. She said, "Oh, he's sick. He's in bed, sick." Saul sent messengers to see David, said, "Bring him up to me on his bed that I may put him to death." When the messengers entered, behold, the household idol was on the bed and a quilt of goat's hair at its head. So Saul got a little ticked at Michal. "Why have you deceived me and let my enemy go that he has escaped?" And Michal said to Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I put you to death?'" Now, it's interesting to me that Michal had a household idol.
And then David was weak enough to.
And David was in that house too at some point in time. So they had a household idol in that thing. Which means probably that Saul had something. Household idols and stuff like that too. You know. But through this thing, David was protected by his wife, who clearly chose David over Saul. A little later on, she probably wouldn't do that. And David was let down through a window and escaped. And he wrote Psalm 59 about this event, when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. And listen to what David says. We're not going to read the whole psalm, but if you want to turn to Psalm 59 in more than a couple months, we'll get there as we go through the psalms. It might take 30 or 40 weeks, but we'll get there. And it starts out, "Deliver me from mine enemies, O God. Set me securely on highway from those who rise up against me. Deliver me from those who do iniquity, and save me from men of bloodshed. For behold, they have set an ambush for my life. Fierce men launch an attack against me, not for my transgressions, nor my sin, O Lord. For no guilt of mine they run and set themselves against me. Arouse yourself to help me and see." That's how he starts out. And then if you go to the end of the psalm in verse 16, It says, but as for me, I shall sing of your strength. Yes, I shall joyfully sing of your loving kindness in the morning, for you have been my stronghold and a refuge in the day of my distress. O my strength, I will sing praises to you, for God is my stronghold, the God who shows me loving kindness. There's a bunch of stuff in the middle, but read that whole psalm if you want to, and we'll get back to it in about a year and get into it in a little more depth. But in this situation, David turned to God. He understood. Now, it wasn't Michael that saved him. It was God. But he used Michael, even though she was, had an idol in the house. And then we go on in verse 18. And it says, now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And Samuel went in and stayed in Naoth. And it was told Saul, saying, behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah. So Saul sent messengers to take David. But when they saw the company of prophets prophesying with Samuel, now we don't know who all those prophets were, and presiding over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. Now, I don't know what that would have looked like. Okay? And when it was told Saul, so Saul said, I'm going to send these messengers, and they go there, and Samuel and the prophets are prophesying. The people that Saul sent started doing it again. Saul said, well, I'm going to send some other people. Saul wasn't paying attention to what was going on. And when it was told Saul, verse 21, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. So Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Saul was intent on killing David, regardless of what God wanted. Then he himself went to Ramah. So Saul said, well, okay, I'm going to do it myself. And he came as far as the large well that is in Seku, and he asked and said, where is Samuel and David? And someone said, they are at Naoth in Ramah. And he proceeded to go there to Naoth in Ramah. And the Spirit of God came upon him also, so that he went along prophesying continually until he came to Naoth in Ramah. And he stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay down naked. That probably means just with his undergarments, not naked. And he too prophesied before Samuel. Oh, so I read that. And laid down naked all day and all night. Therefore, they say, is Saul among the prophets? Is it? Yeah, I mean, interesting thing. But Saul should have figured out God is with David. And God is protecting David. But we're going to see that Saul kept on pursuing him again and again and again and again for a long time, basically until he was going to die. There was a few little respites in there where David would go and eat with the court for a while, and then he'd get all huffy again. And
so Saul didn't prophesy because he believed and trusted God.
No.
God forced that
spirit on him. Yeah. Yes.
Is this prophesying like foretelling a message, or is this like foretelling future? Is there any way to tell?
There is. I'd have to go look at the word. I think it's more of praising God and that, not foretelling the future like we think of as a prophet, but explaining God's truth and that type of a thing. That would be my thought.
Do you think that was also God's way of showing Saul that he's in control no matter what? And,
Well, I don't know if God would have shown Saul that he was in control if Saul had his eyes open and his heart open to listen. But Saul's heart was closed. He wasn't going to listen. But had it been open, he should have seen that. And Samuel, this people should have seen that. All of Saul's servants should have seen that. Because it was pretty obvious. This is what was going on. And it provided David plenty of time to escape. Because it said that Saul was laying down all day and all that night. People were going, what's going on? And David, then, he had plenty of time to get out of Saul's presence, which is what he did. But Saul was not going to be deterred. And then from here, and we'll just have to just introduce this and we'll go further next week before we get into Psalm 3. And you do have the Psalm 3 notes that I sent out. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan. So David knew where Jonathan was. He came and said to him a few questions. What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? You know, because you read all the way through this, David really hadn't done anything. He hadn't tried to be anything but a loyal subject to Saul and a loyal son-in-law to Saul. But the reason why Saul was pursuing him is because Saul saw him as an enemy. Because Saul saw him as, you're going to take my throne away from me. And it wasn't Saul's throne anyway. It was God's throne that he gave to Saul. And if you go back and you read, and we didn't start here, but if you go back and read way back when Saul was first chosen to be king, he was pretty humbled. He was pretty humbled. Wow. Eh? But after being in that position for so long, he started to read his own press clippings and thought he was pretty cool. And then it became his throne, and he wanted to protect it at all cost. That's so typical of human nature. But that's what Saul did. And so David goes to Jonathan after he fled from Naoth and said, what have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? And then we're going to see what Jonathan and David does. And we'll see that next week. I could get into it, but then we'd be really late. And I've got to get up there a little early because I got to do the music in the second service.